Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, October 18, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call on the Federal Trade Commission's 6B Patent Assertion Entity Study. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts. Professor Jorge Contreras, who is an associate professor at S.J. Quinney College of Law. Professor Kristen Asenga, who is a professor of law from University of Richmond School of Law. We have Lori Self, who is a vice president and counsel of government affairs for Qualcomm Incorporated. And last but not least, we have our moderator, Professor Adam Mossoff from the Antonin Scalia Law School. Today, I will turn it over to Adam to get us started. Following remarks from this great panel of experts, we will open the floor for questions. Thank you for speaking with us. Adam, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and it's a real pleasure to be here today with an excellent panel to talk about the Federal Trade Commission's recent release of its long-awaited study of what are called patent assertion entities, or PAEs by the acronym. I am going to take moderator's privilege to set some context for what the FTC's PAE study is about. And then I will turn it over to our panelists to talk about the details of the study and raise some questions about it and discuss implications from it. So to begin with, the context for this study of patent assertion entities, of course, is the longstanding policy debate that's been occurring in Washington, D.C. and in courtrooms and in the broader public policy area more generally about the patent system and its role in promoting innovation, particularly in the high-tech space, but also as well in the biotech space. And a feature of this patent policy debate has been that there are people who own patents and who litigate them or license them, and that they acquire these patents. They're not the inventors themselves, and thus their business model is not manufacturing or commercial services more generally. Their business model is licensing and litigation. And there's been a lot of concerns raised about these types of commercial entities and individuals, which reigns across the span of the innovation industries. It includes individual owners of patents. It includes universities. It includes large companies, small companies, lawyers, and others. And so as part of this broader policy debate and a concern about these issues, the Federal Trade Commission used its authority under 6B of the Federal Trade Commission Act to subpoena information from 22 companies that it identified as patent assertion entities. And importantly, the study defines patent assertion entity, which is nice because a lot of the debates, and even by scholars today, don't define this term in any meaningful way. And they define it as simply a firm that primarily acquires patents and seeks to generate revenue by asserting them against accused infringers. And in fact, one of the nice things about the FTC's PAE study is that it avoids the rhetorical cudgel that has been used in the policy debates. The term that many people probably know of is patent troll, or sometimes the more innocuous sounding NPE, and instead limits its focus upon solely firms that acquire patents. So they purchase them from other people, and that they seek to generate revenue by asserting them against accused infringers. And in its study of these 22 companies, we don't know who the companies are because the disclosure was confidential to the FTC because the companies were disclosing many internal commercial practices at those companies that they do keep confidential. The FTC applied its long-standing distinction that it draws between ex post versus ex ante licensing. So ex ante, of course, is licensing that occurs before there is an accusation of infringement, and ex post is licensing that would occur after an accusation of alleged infringement. And of course, if you're engaging in ex post licensing, the idea is that there has been, of course, some assertion either explicitly through a filing of a complaint or at least a letter asserting that if a complaint will be filed, that serves as the basis for the licensing. And applying this kind of this division that the FTC has been using in its assessment of licensing practices in the innovation industries, ex post licensing versus ex ante licensing, the FTC found that among the 22 companies that it surveyed, that it found that there was a general division between what it called litigation PAEs versus portfolio PAEs. Portfolio PAEs are companies that engage in licensing of very large collections of patents. And litigation PAEs are PAEs who engage in licensing of patents only after a lawsuit has been filed on one or two or fewer than 10 patents. And what they found is that litigation PAEs engage in ex post licensing. Of course, you can see how that follows from their division there between ex post versus ex ante. And portfolio PAEs engage primarily in ex ante licensing. But they found that the 22 companies that they surveyed, of course, only 9% of the total licenses that they found in their survey of these 22 companies were of portfolio PAEs, and yet these 9% of licenses generated 80% of the reported revenue that they found in these 22 companies. Thus, what they found is that, of course, the most of the cases that were being filed were by litigation PAEs, and that they typically yielded royalties of less than $300,000. So that's just kind of a quick survey of the general study and some of their basic terms. From their study of these 22 companies and the fact that they concluded that a significant number of PAEs were litigation PAEs engaging in ex post licensing after the fact litigation, that they then actually concluded with some policy proposals that actually follow and map onto what are some longstanding legislative proposals that have been continually introduced in Congress in various bills for the past several years now. So they propose changes to the rules of federal procedure governing disclosure of real parties in interest. So who is the actual owner of the real patents and calling the shots behind the scenes, so to speak. They propose that customer stays be more easily issued by judges. They also propose other changes to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that would make it easier for discovery proceedings to occur, and of course increasing pleading requirements and the disclosure requirements and complaints being filed by PAEs. And as I said, many of this kind of maps onto a lot of the legislative debates that have been occurring in Congress for the past several years, as I said, and maps onto the broader kind of policy debates that have been going on about patent litigation and the role of patents in the innovation economy more generally. So that's kind of the general overview and the kind of context for this study. It's been long awaited, and it's a very important study, if only because it's going to play a significant ongoing role in these policy debates as the legislation that has been repeatedly introduced in Congress will be continually pushed for as well as reintroduced in the next year if it's not enacted by the end of this year. So with that, we have an excellent panel, a set of panelists, as I mentioned, and you don't want to hear me talk for much longer, so I'm going to turn it over to them. As Nate indicated, we have Professor Kristen Osenga from the University of Richmond School of Law. We will then hear from Professor George Contreras, Associate Professor of Law from the University of Utah. And last, but certainly not least, then we'll hear from Lori Self, Vice President and Counsel of Government Affairs from Qualcomm. So without much further ado, Kristen, why don't you kick off our panel?
Thank you, Adam and Nate. As Adam said, we have been waiting for the FTC to release this study for a long time, and I, just like you, were waiting for it. And before I even start, let me be upfront and say that since the study was proposed and designed and from the get-go, I was skeptical that anything good would come out of the report. I agree wholeheartedly that patent licensing firms are misunderstood, and that we would benefit greatly from more data that lets us understand these firms, who they are, what they do. But from the beginning, I was unconvinced that the FTC study would promote any real understanding of patent licensing firms for two reasons. First, the subjects of the FTC study did not lead to a realistic picture of patent licensing firms. And second, the questions the FTC study asked were not designed to develop an understanding of who these firms are and what they do. And so a couple of years ago, in a Law Review article, I wrote the following sentence. The FTC's narrow view of patent licensing firms and behaviors could, in fact, cause more harm than good. Inaccurate and incomplete data will go far to bolster the inapt theories that are currently holding the day for those who wish to hinder, if not destroy, patent licensing firms. So, first of all, yeah, that sounds like a lot of law professor gobbledygook, but the bottom line is I'm going to stand by that assertion that I made well in advance of the study's release. The bottom line, as I see it, is that the FTC study in this report will end up doing more harm than good. Although I will jump in right now to say in one respect, the FTC study is better than I expected in one way and worse in three. So, before I tell you why I think the FTC's report from the study is a disaster, let me point out the one good thing. Might as well start with the positive that I believe comes from the study. Although this positive point will be severely muted by a more negative point that I'll get to in just a moment. But here's what I think the FTC did right. For the first time, someone other than academics acknowledged that not all patent licensing firms are the same. The FTC's definition of patent assertion entities, PAEs, had already separated out NPEs. And the distinction there is PAEs acquire patents to monetize them, where the FTC's definition of NPEs, non-practicing entities, is firms that develop and patent technology and then monetize them. But the study finally admits something we've suspected all along, and I've studied, that even all PAEs are not homogenous. But that's where I'm going to end with my positive remarks. The FTC study unfortunately breaks PAEs into two categories. The portfolio PAEs, they have large portfolios. They license before they sue, they make lots of money, and they're good. The litigation PAEs, on the other hand, are bad. They have smaller portfolios, their model is to sue and settle. They make less money, and they bring what is classified throughout as nuisance suits. The division between the two categories is far too coarse to be meaningful. There's a lot more than two types of patent assertion entities, and I think breaking them into simply two, while it's a start, is far from a complete picture of how patent licensing firms work. Second of all, the study was designed, by virtue of how these entities were selected for the study, to be focused on litigation PAEs, so it's not terribly surprising that the bulk of the respondents turned out to be these bad, bad patent assertion entities. And even though the FTC believes that these two different types of PAEs are different, and although they don't use the words you are good and you are bad, you can get that through implication through the reading. The interesting thing is that the recommendations, the policy recommendations that the FTC ends up with, don't retain any of that distinction between PAE types. It's like they acknowledge that patent licensing firms are different. They may act differently, they may exist for different purposes, et cetera, but when they put forth these recommendations for legislative and judicial reforms, any differentiation between PAEs ceases to exist. So what was the point of classifying them to start with? I think in order to start a meaningful dialogue about patent licensing firms, what they do well and what they don't do well, it's useful to start thinking about them as many, more than two, heterogeneous groups. But the dialogue has to progress then without lumping them back all up into the PAE as one homogenous group. Okay, so I may have been a little disingenuous in telling you I had a positive point, because clearly the positive point was not even positive. But let's move on to the three big negative points that I also have. And I probably have more than three, but I'll limit myself to three so that you can also hear from George and Lori. So my three gripes are this. First, the policy recommendations shouldn't have been made because the facts gathered were incomplete. Second, the policy recommendations shouldn't have been made because the facts they gathered don't even support the recommendations they made. And third, the policy recommendations are based on what I think is a poor proxy for quote-unquote nuisance litigation. So, first, the facts gathered to justify the policy recommendations are incomplete. Without even starting in on the sample size and how the firms in the FTC's case study, and that's what it is, honestly, it's a case study. Nothing can truly be extrapolated from this data, and the FTC does admit that in some various meetings and what have you that they've had since, but it's a case study. But even putting that aside, there are two big pieces of evidence that are missing. First, The FTC admits in the report that it cannot speak to any efficiencies that patent licensing creates because the data was too hard to collect. Well, that's kind of lame in my opinion, but even if it's true, how in the world can we make recommendations without knowing the other side of the equation? Basically, they gathered up data about litigation and what patent and assertion entities are doing wrong, but when it came time to gather up information about revenue sharing with inventors and any sort of efficiencies that were created by the existence of patent assertion entities, the FTC says, well, that information, the firms keep it in all sorts of different ways, and we can't really figure out what they're doing, so we're just not going to say anything about it. So they left the efficiency side, the positive side of the equation, blank, and then created policy recommendations. So it could turn out, and we don't know, and unfortunately this study was one of the ways we thought we could get to know, but it could turn out, that patent licensing creates all sort of positives for inventors, for innovators, for other companies, for competitors. But because the FTC made their recommendations on patent licensing with no knowledge on the positive effects, it seems like they only did half of the math they needed to do. The other lack of information that I think is missing related to this first point is that they claim that they made their policy recommendations to address information asymmetries. And information asymmetries may very well exist, but in order to determine whether there's information asymmetries, we need to actually have some information from the other side, those being the defendants in these patent litigation cases. And that is information that wasn't gathered. So as it stands, the existence of information asymmetries, which is one of the big justifications that the FTC gave for creating these policy recommendations, the existence is largely based on anecdote, not evidence, and it's information that could have and should have been gathered if the real problem with patent licensing firms is information asymmetry. And so for those reasons, if not many more, the incomplete data that the FTC gathered ended up with it being making poor policy recommendations. The second point, the facts developed by the study don't even support the policy recommendations. So there's facts that are missing, but even the facts that they gave us in this great big 269-page or whatever report don't actually tie in to the policy recommendations they made. And this has been noticed earlier, including by Judge Ginsburg, who spoke at an event for Northwestern University and the Searle Center. His remarks were recently written up in Law 360, if you want to take a gander at them. That while some of these recommendations are completely sound, they are sound because of nothing that has to do with the study. So one of this goes back to my positive point. The study shows that there's different types of PAEs. They behave in different ways, but none of the policy recommendations is aimed at one type or another of PAE. They're simply aimed at the homogeneous patent assertion entity. So they have this study, they use the study to say, hey, there's two, but their recommendations are not tied to the two or one of the two or anything of the sort. Another example is the recommendation to increase disclosure of related entities. We need to know your subsidiaries and related entities if you go to litigation. That's one of the policy recommendations. And although the study may have uncovered that patent licensing firms sometimes have a large number of related entities, and some of the related entities assert patents and some of them don't, the existence of related entities on its own does not justify a call for increased disclosure. The FTC study uncovered no evidence that a lack of disclosure of related entities creates any sorts of problems for innovation at all. So I think I'm going to leave this point with a quote from Judge Ginsburg on the matter, that is that what we got from the FTC's report is, quote, a set of recommendations that is free-floating from the study. The ideas that are otherwise good but unsupported by the study that is supposed to justify these ideas also has to be a poor recommendation. And then finally, and I'll go through it quickly because I want to get to my co-panelists, but my final point today is nuisance litigation is not the same as meritless litigation. And to accept the FTC's proxy for nuisance litigation will result in terrible results. Basically, the FTC alleges that especially the litigation PAE type will engage in litigation that results in less than $300,000 in settlement, which they then say is in the lower band of the costs required to defend a patent litigation suit according to the AIPLA, and so this must be bad. These lawsuits must be stopped. But less than $300,000 is a terrible proxy to determine what suits should be brought and what suits shouldn't be brought. First, nuisance isn't the same as meritless. Nuisance is simply a cost-benefit analysis that would lead us to think whether or not we should bring a suit, but that doesn't mean that there's not infringement. It doesn't mean that the patent's not valid. So that's my first problem. If we start taking an axe to any case that results in less than $300,000 in damages or settles for them less than that, we seem to be opening the door to de minimis or low-level infringement, which is specifically not part of the patent system. The Federal Circuit has said on more than one occasion, de minimis infringement is still infringement. So setting an artificial cutoff for what cases are worth bringing and which cases are not worth bringing seems to take away that right to exclude, which patent law is all about. And second and finally, the factors surrounding patent litigation and settlement are extensive and case-by-case unique. We cannot simply understand what's going on in any given patent litigation by looking at a bare number, like 300,000. In fact, an old textbook I used to teach from, there was a case on patent infringement that went to verdict, and the patentee was awarded $69 and change. $69, not $69,000 or $69 million. And the case was not in the textbook as an example of cases that should not be brought or that are nuisance cases. In fact, the reason I love teaching that case is it explains that there's a lot more going on in patent cases than you can see from the amount of the damage award. And I think the same is true for settlement numbers. So by looking at the settlement numbers and saying, wow, too low, must be a nuisance case, is vastly oversimplifying patent law and, again, results in a poor recommendation. So for those reasons, I'm going to say that the study is going to do more harm than good, as I said a number of years ago, and I will turn it back over to Adam.
Thank you, Kristen. And now, George.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Adam. Thank you to Kristen and the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate in this. For my part, I'd like to commend the FTC for undertaking this really ambitious and difficult project. It's an important area, patent assertion entity transactions, and it's traditionally been obscured by a lack of transparency and closed-door negotiations, so there's not much information out there. So in my allotted time, I'd like to outline my reactions to this study, what it accomplished, what it didn't accomplish, and what I wish had been done differently. And I'll cover these points in three broad areas. First, the study's methodology. Second, some new information that was revealed by the study. And third, the policy recommendations that you've already heard something about. So, as far as methodology, a few subpoints. First is transparency. So, paradoxically, the FTC study suffers from its greatest asset, access to really a treasure trove of confidential commercial licensing and corporate organizational information that it compelled companies to produce under its Section 6B authority. This information gave the FTC unprecedented access to the inner workings of the PAE industry, but the downside of this access is that they can't disclose the information to the public. So, unlike a typical academic study that makes all underlying data available for review, validation, and challenge, the data underlying the FTC study is dark. So this lack of transparency affects not only the underlying survey responses, but also the identities of the survey recipients and the respondents, making it difficult to understand which category a particular entity might fall into or whether it's considered in the results at all. Even more challenging for an empirically oriented researcher like me is the lack of detail regarding the methodology used to select the sample of firms surveyed. So we know that firms were divided into three strata based on the number of patents they held and the number of patent assertions they made. But we don't know what the divisions were between the strata, nor do we know the number of firms selected from each stratum. What we do know is that 25 firms were selected to receive surveys, with some weighting toward the higher end, and the 22 surveys were eventually returned after three were eliminated as not really applicable. So, the second point on methodology is definitions. So every good transactional lawyer knows that negotiation is often won or lost in the definition section. In this case, the study hinges on the definition of patent assertion entity, or PAE, as Adam alluded to in the introduction. So the study defines a PAE as a firm that primarily acquires patents and seeks to generate revenue by asserting them against accused infringers. That definition is not unique, it's not new, it's derived from the FTC's 2011 Evolving Marketplace Report and has been used in a number of other official documents. But there's a problem with the definition, and that it is potentially over-inclusive and under-inclusive at the same time. First, it excludes firms that could be engaged in aggressive patent assertion as their primary business, but which generate those patents internally. So several categories of firms are thus excluded. Failed startups, patent assertion arms of technology developers, and large PAEs that do not make products but generate their own patents that they assert actively in litigation. And it seems that any survey of the PAE market is incomplete without considering these firms. Second, the definition includes the portfolio PAEs, which Kristen and Adam have both alluded to, firms that negotiate large portfolio licenses but without suing the alleged infringers first. So this model is well known in the marketplace. It covers firms like RPX, which we've all heard about for years. The problem with including these entities in this definition is that they probably would not consider them PAEs in the first place. So creating a category of portfolio PAEs to contrast with the more litigious litigation PAEs is odd, and it might in fact create a false comparison, as the portfolio PAEs aren't necessarily acting like the PAEs that many studies and conversations identify. A third methodological point that I have is about the sampling, which Kristen alluded to also, and we know that the survey recipients were not selected methodically to form a representative sample of the PAE marketplace. As a result, the study can't be used to draw generalizable conclusions about the marketplace, and that's been acknowledged both by outside commentators as well as the FTC itself, which says the FTC does not have the resources to conduct a census of the NPE industry, and that the results of this study will not be extrapolated to the population of all NPEs. And this is fine. You know, we understand that agencies operate within limited budgets, especially in this case, the OMB seeks to limit the burden of such studies on industry participants. So, as Kristen mentioned, the FTC refers to this study as a descriptive case study. But actually, in a typical Harvard Business School style case study that describes individual firm or group behavior and strategy, there is a description and identification of the firms and their internal business strategies. This study is limited to presenting anonymous aggregated data with no description of the firms engaged in the activity or their business strategies. We just have the sort of raw aggregated data. So the study is not statistically generalizable to the PAE market, nor is it a fine-grained case study, but it's something in between. And while this is puzzling at first, the constraints that led the agency to this point are not hard to understand. I think the most constructive approach in view of these known limitations is to consider what the study did reveal and the recommendations that emerged from it. So the findings were interesting, right? So despite the methodological issues, there is some new and interesting data regarding the PAE market that we learn. Most of the new findings in the study relate to PAE licensing practices that couldn't be observed generally through the analysis of public litigation records, which are the usual go-to source for academics who are studying this marketplace. Many of the FTC's findings have long been suspected by commentators, but now they've been validated through these data collection efforts. So here are just a few of the findings that I thought were novel and interesting as I read the study. Number one, 77% of the licenses that litigation PAEs enter are for less than $300,000. Now, that number is, as Kristen points out, relatively arbitrary, but the FTC didn't make it up. It's the lower end of the AIPLA's estimated cost of litigating a patent suit, and so we can draw some conclusions from that low settlement value. Another interesting fact, 99% of the litigation PAE licenses that were entered into are for lump sum payments, not running royalties, implying that obtaining a cash payout early is preferable to participating in an ongoing business relating to whatever the patented technology is. Another interesting point, many of the reported litigation PAEs use lawyers on a contingency fee basis. That's long been suspected, but you know, now we have some data to support it. Litigation PAE sue defendants outside of the ICT sector, in sectors including retail, finance, and so forth, and they license them to a greater degree than the portfolio PAEs. About half of the PAEs reported sharing licensing revenue with the inventors. To my mind, I was surprised. I thought it would be higher than 50%, but this is what was reported. And then, really interestingly, the license fees paid to obtain licenses from litigation PAEs vary wildly, sometimes by a factor of 20. This is very interesting for an area that I study, which is FRAND, or Fair, Reasonable, Non-Discriminatory Licensing. When licensing rates vary by a factor of 20, that's got something to say about discriminatory treatment in the marketplace, which is often fine, but sometimes not fine. And we'll get to that in a little bit. So, other findings. Interestingly, despite a lot of public press about this issue, the FTC study found little evidence of demand letter abuse by PAEs. That is, sending hundreds or thousands of vaguely worded demand letters to unwitting small business owners in the hope of extracting big settlement fees, or even small settlement fees, rather. So this result is even more surprising, given both the notoriety of this practice by the PAE Innovatio, which was alleged to have sent thousands of demand letters to coffee shops and motels over their use of public Wi-Fi, and the FTC's own litigation against MPHJ, which it alleged had sent 16,000 demand letters to small businesses seeking $1,200 per employee to practice patents on networked document scanning. So how did the study miss this phenomenon? It's something that I definitely expected to see here. One possibility is the way that PAE was defined, with a heavy emphasis on filed litigation. So even though MPHJ sent out thousands of demand letters, it didn't really file suit after those demand letters. So with that known, both to the agency and to the industry, it would seem that some correction in the selection criteria could have been developed in order to fill that crack in the study that allowed what is, you know, still possibly a significant phenomenon, but we're not sure about it, to be recorded. Then another finding that I found quite surprising related to standards essential patents, and this is a finding that I've got some reservations and concerns about. So this is an area that I study pretty heavily. In a recent study that I conducted of SEP assertion by non-practicing entities, we found approximately 500 separate assertion events of standards essential patents in the United States between 2000 and 2015, and this is assertion events measured in the same way that the FTC measures them in the PAE study. This was 500 events for 7 standards. We also found that 77% of assertions of standards essential patents were brought by NPEs, which is a large majority, more than 3/4 of the assertions. But the FTC study found that between 2009 and 14, PAEs brought approximately 3,900 patent assertions. It's about 7 times the number of SEP assertions that we identified. Yet they report that respondents only identified 1% of their patent holdings as SEPs. 1%, that's tiny. That statistic could be interpreted as implying that SEPs play an insignificant role in the overall PAE litigation landscape, which is a conclusion that I believe is somewhat misleading and not accurate. And there are a couple of likely methodological reasons for this discrepancy, which I don't have time to go in now, but happy to discuss if anybody other than myself is interested. So on to the policy recommendations. Recall that the survey respondents reported to hold 75% of all patents held by PAEs. This is around 37,000 patents. So notwithstanding issues with the definition of PAE, it's still a lot of patents that are held. And even though the results aren't generalizable to the entire marketplace, the fact that certain practices were observed and emerge in relatively large numbers does indicate that they exist and are significant, at least in the sample studied, and probably more broadly. So as a result, I do think that the PAE study offers a valid basis for the agency to make policy recommendations addressing any inefficiencies or abusive practices that they observed. That being said, they made 4 policy recommendations, and Adam described them, so I won't repeat those here. But, you know, I think that each of these proposed reforms is sensible and is probably needed. But as Adam also pointed out, they're not unique, right? These recommendations have been made numerous times before, going back at least to a spate of competing patent amendment bills that arose during the 2012-13 congressional session. Even so, You know, they're not being graded for originality here. I think it's valuable for the FTC to show renewed support for proposals like these, given that it's now been a few years, and admittedly, congressional interest in patent reform seems to have waned a bit since 2012 and 2013. Even so, it's notable that the FTC's proposals here are basically procedural fixes that would probably benefit patent litigation across the board.
George, I'd like to move the panel on a little bit.
Can you wrap
it up a little bit?
Just about to finish.
Okay.
So I actually agree with Christian in this sense that the recommendations aren't necessarily tied to the results of the study, and they also avoid more controversial proposals such as venue reform, which has been in the news lately, fee shifting and demand letter abuse, that there was an opening to make. In addition, findings like the heterogeneity of PAE record-keeping practices didn't lead to any recommendations, and they could have. So to conclude, I think the FTC has done a great service by beginning this huge task of understanding the PAE marketplace, but I want more. I want more data released to the public. I want more coverage of the PAE marketplace, and I'd like more consideration of policy responses that are based on the licensing and litigations models revealed by the new data. So thanks very much. Sorry for being verbose.
Thanks, George. Appreciate it. So the final speaker on our panel will be Lori Self. And then just as a reminder to the audience, you will have the opportunity to ask some questions if we still have some time remaining before the top of the hour. So if you do have some questions, just hold on to those. Or if you're thinking about some questions, just start to formulate them now because you'll have the opportunity to ask them. So Lori?
Okay. Thanks, Adam, and thank you to the Federalist Society for this opportunity. So let me begin by providing some context. For those of you who don't know Qualcomm, we are one of the world's leading developers of wireless communications technologies. And I'd like to talk for a few minutes about the role of patents and licensing in the mobile sector, because mobile was one of the focal points of the FTC study, though they don't provide a very compelling reason for focusing on mobile. I think it's important to note at the outset that there's no evidence that patent licensing has harmed competition in the mobile sector. And to the contrary, mobile is arguably the most dynamic, competitive, and successful industry in our history, and patent licensing has played a crucial role in driving R&D investments, technological advances, and economic growth. So our history as a company is very closely linked to the history of the mobile revolution. We were founded in 1985 by leading experts in wireless communications who understood the potential of mobile communications long before a product or market existed. And over the past three decades, we've invested more than $42 billion in R&D and licensed our patented technologies very broadly throughout the ecosystem. And just keep in mind that with each new generation of core mobile technology, the move from 2G to 3G to 4G and now 5G, you're looking at about 10 years of R&D investments without any guarantee that those investments will pay off. So from a policy perspective, how can a company like Qualcomm, how can any innovative company for that matter, justify these very large, very high-risk investments in the development of mobile or other technologies? In my view, there are three critical legal pillars that are not only fundamental to the explosive growth of the mobile ecosystem, but to any innovative sector. First, a strong system of property rights, patent property rights, that creates economic incentives to invest in R&D. Second, a robust rule of law that recognizes contractual freedom, including licensing, and provides meaningful remedies and due process. And then finally, a commitment to regulatory restraint. And in the context of antitrust enforcement, that notion of regulatory restraint, if you will, is embodied in the DOJ's 1995 IP antitrust guidelines, which recognize the pro-competitive benefits of patent licensing and commits to symmetrical treatment of IP and real property rights for purposes of antitrust enforcement. And so why do I provide that context? I do so because over the past decade, we have seen, as Adam alluded to, a fundamental erosion of each of these legal pillars of a strong innovation economy. And within the courts, within Congress, within our agencies, we are seeing a series of decisions and actions that have fundamentally undermined the property rights foundation of patents, as well as a commitment to strong remedies, to due process. And we have seen a departure, in my view, by the FTC and DOJ from the 1995 IP antitrust guidelines. And of course, as Adam mentioned, this is being driven by this narrative, which underlies in part the FTC study, that we have a PAE or NPE or troll litigation crisis. And so for a decade now, we've been living in the midst of this rapidly changing patent landscape driven by a tremendous amount of rhetoric and anecdote. And that's where the FTC stepped in and where it could have played an enormously beneficial role by clearing away the rhetoric, which of course is being driven by special interests and commercial self-interest, and bringing evidence to a debate that, as Adam has said in the past, is often fact-free. And in that regard, I view the FTC's report as a missed opportunity. As others have said, some of the data that the FTC brought to bear is interesting. There are interesting observations. But there's also assumptions and conclusions that are unwarranted on the basis of that data. And as Kristen alluded to, feel biased in their assumptions, namely this notion that all litigation under the value of $300,000 is per se nuisance. And the fact that the FTC tacked on these policy prescriptions that are not firmly rooted in the data, I think, is the most problematic aspect of the report. And in doing so, unfortunately, I think the FTC undermined its own credibility with this report by converting what could have been an objective, fact-based report into a document that feels too much like political advocacy. The question, of course, is, we can speculate on why the FTC decided to make these untethered policy recommendations, these free-floating policy recommendations. But in some respects, it doesn't matter. But the reality is that regardless of the FTC's intentions, this report will be touted by advocates of patent litigation reform as proof positive that a troll or PAE-driven litigation crisis exists, and endorsement of certain highly contentious, highly complex litigation reforms that have been the focal point of very heated debate over the past 3 years. And in fact, we're already seeing that consequence with statements by certain large tech groups mischaracterizing the study as, again, proof of a crisis and an endorsement of the need for further legislative reform. And of course, as others have already said, the FTC study proves nothing. It is a case study, as the FTC has conceded. At most, it is an exploratory survey of a small sample of PAEs and the starting point for additional research. The fact that the FTC has treated this case study as the basis for sweeping policy changes, I think, is very troubling. So let's talk a bit about why Qualcomm cares. I mean, you could argue that we're not a PAE. These recommendations are limited to patent assertion entities, a relatively small percentage of patent owners. What's the harm? The harm, of course, is that once these recommendations are translated into legislation, they will apply to all patent owners. No matter the business model, no matter the value of the patent, they will be used as justification for sweeping litigation reforms that will undermine the value and enforceability of all patent rights. And again, going back to my original point, doing further damage to those fundamental pillars that drive investments in innovation, the property-based foundation of patent rights, the guarantee of a rule of law backed by meaningful remedies and due process and the commitment to regulatory restraint. So just to focus on one of the policy recommendations that the FTC has endorsed, the customer stay proposal that Adam alluded to, the somewhat benign rationale for this recommendation is that mom and pops and other end users should not be subjected to patent litigation when, in fact, a manufacturer is available to step into the litigation. It sounds reasonable. In fact, a customer suit exception already exists under the common law. Motions to stay litigation in true customer suit scenarios are often granted by courts. I think it's something like 70 to 75% of the cases. It all sounds very reasonable, despite the fact that the recommendation has no basis in the findings of the report. So what's the problem? The problem is that the customer stay language that's been part of the House and Senate bills for 3 years now is far more complex and has a very different purpose than what is described in that simple rationale. In fact, the customer stay language that's part of H.R. 9 and S. 1137 would provide a kind of immunity from any kind of infringement liability for a broad range of very sophisticated large end users as well as technology aggregators, and would force patent owners, all patent owners, not just PAEs, to pursue remedies upstream against component manufacturers, many of which are likely to be based outside the United States. So again, you have an example of what is a seemingly benign, sensible policy recommendation translated into something very different, far more insidious in the context of legislation. And that dynamic will exist with every single recommendation included in the FTC's report. The FTC also fails to acknowledge the drastically changing landscape that patent owners confront in today's environment. The fact that through Supreme Court decisions, the American Invents Act, and other numerous changes, patent owners exist in an environment that's increasingly hostile to the enforcement of rights, even legitimate enforcement activity. So again, to a point that I think was made earlier, the fact that the FTC does nothing to look at how that landscape has changed or to how that landscape has altered the behavior of users of patented technology, I think is a real problem and missed opportunity that's reflected in the study's policy recommendations. Many in the startup community refer to a new business model that's emerged as a result of this drastically changing landscape, a business model called efficient infringement, where very large users of patented technology simply ignore patent rights with the full understanding and appreciation that even if patents are asserted in court, there are so many tools and means of avoiding any kind of remedies or any kind of liability that there's really very little incentive to come to the negotiating table or to even consider the potential validity of the patent or merits of the infringement allegation. Again, so when we talk about asymmetries of litigation costs, I think if anything, startups would argue today those asymmetries overwhelmingly favor large companies and large users of patented technology.
Lori, can you also just wind it up a little bit so we have some time for question and answer?
Right. So just in conclusion, a patent system that encourages infringement with impunity cannot sustain R&D-driven innovation, which is critical to America's leadership in the mobile economy and other sectors. And to say the least, it's unfortunate and troubling that the FTC report ignores this changing reality. Thanks, Adam.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you to all of the panelists who have given just really great comments, wide-ranging on hitting on all aspects of the FTC's PA study itself, the broader issues in patent litigation, patent licensing, and the role that that these issues are having in innovation industries. So Nate, I'll turn it back over to you to run the queue for the questions from the audience.
Sure thing. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request a floor, enter star, then the pound sign on your phone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad.
Well, while we're waiting, Nate, I'll just go ahead and throw out a question to the panelists. Some of you have hit on the issue all of you have hit on various aspects of the issue of the selection effects in the sample of the 22 companies that they surveyed, and the lack of symmetries in the evidence that they acquired in terms of costs on the one side but not benefits on the other. Is there also a broader lack of symmetry in some of the proposals, particularly on the policy side, based upon their study, in the terms of comparison to litigation more generally? So, for instance, they talk about how and they quote from the Federal Circuit Center's Patent Case Management Judicial Guide about how patent litigation is very difficult and exhaustive and expensive. Is there a question there, though, as compared to what? Is it more so than other complex commercial litigation, other complex, litigation over, administrative regulations and things of that sort? So I was curious to know if any of the panelists had any thoughts on this.
So this is Laurie Self. I'll just comment and would encourage Kristen and George to weigh in. I think it's a very fair question. I know Dan Spulver from Northwestern has raised that same question. If you look at litigation and costs of patent litigation, the question is compared to what? And the what is a highly valuable multi-trillion dollar IP ecosystem that has propelled U.S. economic growth for our entire history. And if you look at average litigation rates over time, you find a remarkably constant rate of litigation per patent, somewhere between 1% and 2% of issued patents are actually subject to litigation. So I do think that's an important point, and of course it's a point that's lost in the FTC report and lost in the broader narrative around patent litigation and so-called PAE litigation.
I can jump in, Adam, also with a follow-on on that. I don't disagree with what Laurie said, but what you've asked is really a broader question, right, about the litigation environment in the United States. And it's, I don't think, a secret to anybody that there is more litigation in the U.S. than there is in just about any other country, and that's including, China, where, you do see statistics about large amounts of litigation, but that is by far and away much smaller, and often relating to utility patents and whatnot. So if you compare patent litigation to other litigation, I think there is a general trend. There's just a lot of litigation in the United States, and that is not necessarily good for small businesses, for innovation, and so forth. And, look at other movements that have occurred in the United States around litigation, around tort reform, for personal injury suits, class action litigation reform, medical malpractice litigation, right? I mean, you see very similar patterns in sort of complaints that there's too much of this litigation, followed by legislative and regulatory attempts to limit the opportunities for that litigation to adversely impact efficiency and the market. And so I don't think it's that different. I mean, patent infringement, it's a tort, after all, just like personal injuries and medical malpractice. I think it's appropriate to look at it in that broader context. And, I think that efforts to limit it are probably well-placed in that broader context as well.
Let me just, if I could just add, though, I just to respond to Jorge's comments, or George's comments, I'm sorry. Of course, patents are a property right, so you can't analogize patents to just any other tort litigation. I think that's an important point. And I also, for those of us who have delved deeply into these legislative proposals, I don't think anyone could argue that these particular proposals that are currently before Congress will decrease litigation costs. They are all highly complex, sui generis approaches to civil procedure, really treating patent litigation as some sort of separate, unique creature under our litigation system that would undeniably and undoubtedly increase litigation costs. So although I think we can all agree that increasing the efficiency and transparency and rationality of litigation is a good thing, the problem, of course, is that the legislative agenda that's currently before Congress would have the opposite effect.
Adam, do you have time for me to respond?
Sure. Yes, please do.
Okay. Awesome. So I agree with the bulk of what's been said. I just wanted to chime in with one separate thought. I actually have a law professor colleague working in this area across disciplines. So she's looking at it with Med-Mal, with employment discrimination, et cetera, all of these various areas of law, and looking at how the rules of civil procedure can be used to shut down some litigation that we don't like, et cetera. And the constant argument I have with her, and the one that I would put forth here, is just you're presuming we have a problem. Don't fix what we don't know is a problem yet. And for sure, don't get me wrong, there's plenty of problems, but I don't think the FTC study at all supports the fact that there is a problem. And before we go and fix things, I would rather just see that there is a problem. So leave you there.
Great. Nate, is there anyone in the queue yet?
Yes, we do have one caller waiting patiently. Why don't we go to that
excellent
question right now?
Hey, this is Bill Wickerman at Covington & Brilling. Question for anybody. On this, I'd love to tease out this question of large versus small, and the fact that the study actually indicates that, you know, these small nuisance suits of lesser money, lesser amounts of money would have, would not those recommendations have a disproportionately negative effect on the small inventor? And how does that play into the larger debate going on in the public policy realm now?
So this is Laurie again. I think in general, the legislation that's currently before Congress and that this report appears to endorse or at least encourage disproportionately impacts small inventors, startups, and disproportionately harms those entities in significant part for the reasons that I earlier stated. It would each of these proposals in combination are drafted in such a way that the cost of litigation becomes far greater. Just trying to navigate these new rules would impose incredible cost, complexity, risk for patent owners, particularly startups. And again, this sort of assumption that litigation is per se nuisance purely because the value of the litigation is under $300,000, I think is also very problematic. And I think it also represents a way in which this report suggests a different asymmetrical treatment of patent rights and real property rights. And so I think whenever you undermine the kind of property foundation of patent rights, the smaller entities are going to feel the negative consequences of that most acutely, in part because of the fact that they can no longer get venture capital funding. And that's a dynamic that we are seeing in the real world today. As we destabilize and diminish our patent system, smaller patent owners are finding it increasingly difficult to get funding. And, of course, that has profound implications for the broader economy.
Yeah, well, so this is George. I guess I have a slightly different take on the question, which is about whether the FTC's proposals would disproportionately impact small inventors. And And I don't see how they wouldn't. In fact, I think it would be fairly easy for small inventors to comply with these recommendations, which are not overly complex, right? I mean, they're pretty simple. I don't really see, for a small inventor, why it would be very difficult to disclose real parties in interest. Generally, there are just a couple. Or why it would be difficult to, you know, plead with specificity what you're claiming is infringing. You know, for the small inventors, I think it's actually easy to comply with these requirements. It's when you get into large patent holders with complex organizational structures and hundreds or thousands of holding company affiliates in the U.S. and overseas that you do get into a significant record-keeping and reporting burden. But again, I think that affects a particular, you know, assertion business model, and not your small inventor who's invented something that's valuable and finds somebody infringing. I mean, I think that there would be very little impact on that small inventor's litigation cost by simply complying with these four, I think overly modest recommendations.
Well, let me just give you an example, George, because I think the focus is not only what the FTC recommends, it's how those recommendations will instrumentalize the legislation that's already before Congress. And to my point that, you know, as implemented or translated, if you will, into legislative language, the pleading standard, for example, and I think it's worth noting that the Judicial Conference has already imposed a heightened pleading standard, but the kind of pleadings on steroids, if you will, that's currently under consideration in the House and Senate would impose enormous costs, enormous complexity, just to file, just to initiate a litigation. The amount of information you would have to include about the patent and the nature of the infringement goes so far beyond our notice pleading system that it would become a deterrent, cost prohibitive for many small entities. And that's just one example. But again, you can't simply focus on the recommendations. You really have to look at the legislation that they are meant to endorse.
Well, we are at the top of the hour, and Nate, are there any other questions?
No, we don't have any questions currently.
All right.
Waiting online.
Well, this was a wide-ranging and great exchange of views about the FTC's PAE study itself, but also about the broader policy proposals that we have seen in Congress concerning patent litigation that, of course, the FTC study is itself promoting and advocating for as a result of its study. Thank you to the panelists, to Kristen and to George and to Lori for excellent comments and great back and forth discussion in response to some of the questions. And I hope everyone has enjoyed this as well on the phone. And as always, these are recorded as podcasts, so you will also be able to listen to it. And please share and share with family and friends as widely as possible. Nate,
yes,
I turn it over to you.
Very good. And before we conclude, just one programming note. Our next Teleforum conference call will be from our Financial Services Practice Group tomorrow, Wednesday, October 19th at 3 p.m. We will host a conversation which will provide an update on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I just want to say on behalf of the Federal Society, thank you to Professor Contreras, Professor Osenga, Ms. Self, and Professor Massoff for your time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.